Well, in one sense, we're going to continue the series that we're involved in this morning with Exodus, and in another sense, we're going to be backing up a bit from it and looking at the lay of the land, circumstances surrounding this book as a whole. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about where we are up until this point. So far, in Exodus, we've seen that it is a story, an incredible story that focuses primarily on the remarkable relationship that God has not only established with His people, but that He is ultimately committed to with His people because of the covenant that He's made with us. This story that's recorded for us on the pages of Exodus holds incredibly significant hope for the entirety of the human race. From the days of the original Exodus that we're reading about with Moses and Aaron until today, this story holds out hope. Every captive is offered the hope of freedom and deliverance. Every soul that's in bondage is extended an opportunity to be free. You may remember that as we opened up the beginning of Exodus, we see right from the get-go that this major player from the previous book in Genesis has died. Joseph has died. And not only Joseph, but all of his brothers and that entire generation, the writer of Exodus records for us. Egypt had appeared to be such a promising place for the Israelites to mature into a godly nation. But in time, it had become a place of terrible bondage, and not much more than that. So after Joseph dies and all of his generation, there's a new king, a new Pharaoh, and the people of God had been given certain privileges because of who Joseph was previously. But this new king arose over Egypt, and he didn't know anything about Joseph and didn't care to know anything about Joseph, and he was a bit fearful at the rapidly growing population of the Hebrews. And so he said that he needed to deal wisely with them. And in his wisdom, he appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. He instructed his people, the Egyptians, to compel the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, to make their lives bitter with hard labor, laboring in mortar and bricks, and all kinds of labor in the field, every kind of labor we could imagine was imposed on them. But this philosophy, this wisdom of Pharaoh was in opposition to the wisdom of God, and so things didn't pan out so well. So Pharaoh turns then and switches from this strategy of slavery to a strategy of slaughter. And he commands the midwives that are helping the Hebrew women give birth to just kill the sons when they're born. And this was his way of dealing with it. But again, his wisdom didn't compare with the wisdom of God because the midwives chose to fear God rather than the king. So the Pharaoh goes all out this next time and he commands all his people, saying that every son who is born among the Hebrews should be thrown into the Nile. So he's gone from slavery and oppression to infanticide to now gender-selective genocide. The previously hidden sin where Pharaoh had just gone and whispered behind the curtain to the Hebrew midwives, if it's a little boy, kill it, pretend something happened. Now it's just out in the open where he says, if any of the Hebrews have a son, he has to go in the Nile. And it was in the midst of these circumstances, these terribly dark days, that we can see a little bit of light on the horizon when Moses is born. He's born into these dark circumstances, yet his parents, by faith, defied the king, not fearing man, but fearing God instead. And they hid Moses in a closet for as long as they could before putting him in a basket close to the bank of the Nile. Moses' mom secures him in a basket and places him in that river that no doubt would have been the grave for so many of Moses' peers. And then Moses' mom sends his little sister, his big sister, her little girl, to watch the events unfold as the king's daughter comes down to bathe in the Nile and discover the baby. And we see here, remarkably, the great river and the royal house are both subjected to God's sovereign control. And there's a little bit of hope on the horizon with the coming of Moses. Even more so when we see that he's now grown up to the age of 40. I'm not grown up yet, evidently. But when he grew up at the age of 40, he refused to remain the daughter of Pharaoh. And he set out in his own strength to do what he understood in his own understanding of his role of leading the people of God, delivering them from bondage to the Egyptians. But as a result of taking things into his own hands, he actually delays the deliverance another 40 years. It appears that near the end of this 40 years, even Moses himself is becoming despondent and wondering if it's ever going to happen. So much so that he names his son when he's born, literally, "I'm a sojourner in a foreign land." Moses was very much aware that he was not where he was supposed to be. He had discovered up until this point that there was absolutely no hope in family or lineage. I mean, this was the line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph, Judah. We can add him in there. Which is helpful for us to see that a multi-generational focus is far too short-sighted when we're dealing with the things of God. It's evident that there's no real hope in human leadership. There was a new king that arose, and this is actually what gave them problems. We will be no better off with a mere change in leadership, even if it's at the very top of the chain of command. It will do us no good, spiritually speaking. We've also realized up until this point in the story that there's no hope in sanctification by suffering, because just going through hard times guarantees nothing but hard times. And we see as well that there's no hope in a mere man, even a great leader like Moses. I mean, he's quite the leader, but he failed here on the front end. And we can fast forward to the end of his life and see that he failed again due to disobedience and lack of trust and belief in God. Yet, in light of the miserable situation, there's still hope. Not only was there hope then for the Israelites who are living in these circumstances, the same hope that they had is hope for us. Hope in a God who is meticulously detailing our lives for our final and ultimate good. I mean, that's what we see here in the Israelites. When finally that king dies off, another king rises, and they sigh and they groan, crying out to God. And the same hope that they had in crying out to God, we have if we cry out to him, that he will hear us, that he will pay attention to us, that he will see us in our distress, that he will help us by coming down to rescue us, not staying far off and sending smoke signals, but coming down and dwelling in the midst of us. We see this most wonderfully displayed when he sends his own son, who left the realm of heaven, all of bliss. That's all he had ever known was eternal bliss. And God sent him to be born in a manger, in a barn, and to live his life on the dirty streets of Nazareth. He came for the purpose of rescuing a people, rescuing us from our sin for himself. That's what we see happening here in Exodus chapter 3 that we looked at more closely last week. God's setting Moses apart for this great deliverance. Moses was going about the daily grind, we might say. And God appears to him. He comes down in the burning bush, visiting Moses, visiting his people, making clear that his intention is not only to call Moses to himself, but to call Moses into himself in order to commission him and send him out. And this is really amazing when we consider Moses' life up until this point. It hasn't been all that great. He was raised in Pharaoh's house. He probably had a really good education, was granted immense wisdom, no doubt. He did walk away from that. He traded it for the treasures of Christ, the writer of Hebrews tells us, but immediately takes things into his own hands. He sees a Hebrew fighting an Egyptian, and he goes out, kills the Egyptian, buries him in the sand, has to leave the country. He's going to be no help at all to his people who are in Egypt if he can't live in Egypt because he's wanted for murder in Egypt. And now God's calling him from Midian, where he's wandered off to now, when he got married and began working for Jethro as a shepherd. Now God's calling him back to himself and saying, Moses, you're the man for this job. And Moses' response to God calling him to himself seems like good evidence of why we would call God into question for even considering Moses again. I mean, he calls Moses and says, this is what I want you to do. And Moses immediately begins with objections, countering everything that God has asked him to do. Beginning with, who am I? Well, for one, you're self-centered, Moses, because it doesn't matter who you are. What matters is, I will be with you. So who are you? I am, God says. Eternal, unchanging, self-dependent, self-sufficient. I'm enough, and I'll be with you, Moses. Okay, well, that's who I am and this is who you are. But what about them? What if they won't listen? They will. Watch this. Throw your staff on the ground. Put your hand inside your cloak. Scoop some water up out of the Nile. And the staff became a serpent. His hand became leprous. The Nile turned to blood. Okay, so if they will listen because of these signs, what am I going to do about my stammering tongue? Moses, who made your tongue? God asks. Not only did God make his tongue, but he's made every tongue that's ever been made. Well, God, why not send someone else, anyone else but me? And God, in anger at this point, I mean, we were angry from the beginning with Moses, right? But God's patience and kind in his answering. Finally, he is angry with him. And he says, your brother speaks pretty good, right? We'll just use him. Moses was inadequate, unable, incompetent, ineffective. He lacked eloquence and he was outright unwilling. Yet God overcomes all of these with one primary answer. I will be with you. I wonder if that's enough for any of us. In what life has for us tomorrow or in the distant future, will it be enough that we serve a God who's promised to be with us? Inadequacy, inability, incompetency, ineffectiveness, unwillingness, all are overcome. Not because of anything in us, but because of him who says, I will be with you. I am with you always. Even to the end of the world, when I go away to prepare a place for you, I will not leave you as orphans, but I will send another comforter, one just like me, of the same kind as me, and he will be with you. And so as Moses is set out on his way, then he thinks all is well. And all of a sudden, then, when he's just preparing for this amazing feat of leading all of the people of God out of bondage into the promised land, all of a sudden, God's so angry with him that he's just before death. God's attempting to kill Moses. Fortunately, for Moses' sake and for our sake as well, I wonder if you thought about it that way, Zipporah, Moses' wife, steps in, realizes what the problem is, does what Moses was unwilling to do by bringing the son into the covenant through circumcision, connecting Moses to it by throwing the foreskin at his feet, so that Moses is then, all of a sudden, he's just on his deathbed, and now he's okay to continue the journey. Because his wife was willing to stand in where he was unwilling to be obedient. Yet still, God is committed to using this man to rescue his people. Now, that is a quick summary, not quick enough, probably with the time, but it's a quick summary of where we've been up until this point. Now, imagine the screen dropping on the story where we are. Okay? And we have a scribe come in, and on his large easel, he's taking his quill and his ink, and he's writing these words. About a dozen centuries earlier. And the screen comes back up. And it's just blackness. Emptiness. Formless. Void. And then these words. Let there be light. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And when God said, let there be light, there was light. And God saw that there was light, and it was good. And he went so far as to separate the light from the darkness and called the light day and the darkness night. So there was evening and there was morning. And this was day one, the very beginning of the history of our world. And if we continue fast forwarding and able to, in order to catch up with the complete background up until where we jumped in a couple of weeks ago with Exodus chapter 1. Next, God says, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, separating the waters from the waters. And he called it heaven. And that was the second day. Let the waters below the heavens be gathered all into one place and cause dry land to appear. And God saw that it was good. And then he called on the earth to sprout forth vegetation. And he called there to be lights in the skies. The sun and the moon were created. That day there was evening and there was morning. That was the fourth day. Then God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heaven. The fifth day. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle, creeping things, beasts of the earth after their kind. And it was so. And then God said, let us make man and let us make him in our image, according to our likeness. And we'll cause him to rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and the cattle and over the earth and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And if we jump forward one chapter, we see the specifics of how this happened, that the Lord God formed man out of the dust of the ground, then breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being, which is remarkable. Okay. 7 days previous, there was nothing. Blackness, void, emptiness, nothing but God, Father, Son, and Spirit for all time. That's all there had ever been. 7 days later, there is a mature earth created with a sun and a moon. There's morning and evening, day and night. Animals filling the earth, stars shining forth in their fullness in the evenings. And man, like you and me, roaming the earth. God went a bit further and he created a special place, a garden for man to live in. And not to live in alone, seeing that it wasn't good for him to be alone. He went out of his way, put him to sleep, took out a rib and formed woman. I mean, some of you guys have creative minds and will make a living. Some of you do with being inventors and are trying to think of different things all the time. But who thinks of this kind of thing? Scraping up some dust together and breathing into the nostrils and creating life. And then taking a rib out of that which you've made it and creating a woman who's a suitable. That doesn't mean okay helpmate, not like a perfect helpmate. Man and woman, Adam and Eve, living in the garden, received commands or expectations from God. They were perfectly sufficient to stand in righteousness all the days of their lives. As long as they ate from every tree in the garden, except the one that God said not to. From any tree in the garden you may eat freely, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat from it you will surely die. Has God said you shall not eat from any tree in the garden? The deceiver asks. Well, Eve responded, from the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat. From the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God has said you shall not eat from it or touch it, or you will die. Surely you won't die. You know what the problem is? God knows that if you eat from it, then you're going to be like him. You'll be able to see the difference between good and evil, righteousness and unrighteousness. Being deceived by him, the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to her eyes, that the tree was desirable to make one wise. She took fruit, she ate, tossed it to Adam. He followed suit. The eyes of both were opened. They were shamed. They realized their nakedness. Then attempted to cover their nakedness with their own self-righteousness, sewing together fig leaves. God, hearing what happened or seeing what happened, approaches them. Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you not to eat? Adam says, that woman that you gave me, she gave me of the tree, and yes, I ate. What's this you have done? God asked Eve. The serpent deceived me, and I ate. And shortly after, when God turns to the serpent, judges him, but also offers a wonderful promise. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel, which is a wonderful promise. And we see it beginning to come to fulfillment just a few verses later, when Genesis 3:21 says that God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife, and he clothed them. You remember I added a little bit to the scriptures just a few moments ago when I said in self-righteousness they tried to cover themselves with fig leaves. Now, it doesn't say that they went out and sewed themselves garments of skin. It says God did it. God made them. And God clothed them through the shedding of blood. Without the shedding of blood, there's no remission of sins. And the effects of this original sin entering into the garden there with Adam and Eve are evident, not just in our world today, but if we turn one page in our Bibles, Genesis chapter 4, the effects of sin are clearly seen. I mean, it's a really poor argument for us to say that things are worse now than they've ever been. In one generation, from Adam and Eve to Cain and Abel, it went from taking a bite of forbidden fruit to murdering your brother. Things are not getting worse. Sin is bad from the beginning. And there's no such thing as small sin. I mean, this is one generation, a page. It might even be on the same page in your Bible. Taking a bite of forbidden fruit to murder within the family. Sin is a major issue and it's spread. Like Paul to the church at Rome made clear, through one man sin entered into the world. And we're all guilty now of that original sin and are by nature children of wrath. And because we are sin, it at the core, all that we do apart from Christ is sin. So therefore we are sinners. We're sinners because we are sin first. So things continued to get worse. And the Lord looked out on the wickedness of man, and he realized that it was incredibly great throughout the whole earth. It was so bad, he even says that every intent of the thought of man's heart was only evil continually. It was so bad when God scanned the earth that he was sorry that he had made man. He was grieved in his heart. So much so that he said, I will blot out man that I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals, to creeping things and to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made any of them. But this wonderful contraction, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. The earth was terribly corrupt in the sight of God. It was filled with violence. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me. The earth is filled with violence because of them. I'm going to destroy them with the earth. Make for yourself an ark. And God details exactly how he ought to go about doing that. All the specifics, Noah obeys in faith, hearing from God and then doing what God has said. He continues on, I'm bringing a flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that's on the earth will perish. But, Noah, I'm going to establish a covenant with you. You remember, we've seen that this already exposed in the opening chapters of Exodus, that God has a covenant with his people. He's committed to rescuing them. And here we see it in the days of Noah. God is establishing a covenant with Noah, saying, you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And Noah did. According to all that God had commanded, he did. What a statement. Everything that God commanded Noah, he did. Quite a contrast from our friend Moses. God continues on in Genesis 7, I'll send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I'm going to blot out from the face of the earth every living thing that I've made. And again, it's repeated. Noah did according to all that the Lord had commanded him. And that's why when the flood did come upon the earth and rain fell for 40 days and it increased, eventually it lifted up the ark and Noah and his family and those animals that Noah put inside the ark at the command of God were saved. Though the water prevailed and increased greatly upon the earth, the ark floated above the surface of the water. The water prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered, and all flesh that moved on the earth perished, birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth, and all mankind and all that was on the dry land, and all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life died. God blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the land. From man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky, they were all blotted out from the earth. And only Noah was left together with those that were with him in the ark. And again, this wonderful statement. But God remembered Noah, and he didn't leave him there in the ark. He not only remembered Noah, Genesis 8 tells us that God remembered all the beasts and cattle that were with him inside the ark. Noah was probably more aware of the beasts and cattle than God was after 40 days with them inside the ark. God caused the wind to blow to pass over the earth, which caused the waters to subside. And God again says to Noah, I am establishing a covenant with you, and not just you, but your descendants after you. And put a bow in the cloud, what we call a rainbow, so that Moses could look up and remember this everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that's on the earth, that God would never destroy the earth through floodwaters again. Noah and his family rescued from the ark. People again begin to multiply. God has redeemed a remnant for himself through the flood, through the ark. And people begin to multiply. And it's not long. They're growing fast with great rapidity before they say, banding together, you know what? We should come together and build for ourselves a city. And within that city, we'll make a tower. A tower that will be so high it will reach into heaven. You know what we're going to do? We're going to make a name for ourselves. I mean, if we don't, we're going to be scattered abroad over the whole face of the earth. So let's make a name for ourselves. Well, obviously they couldn't escape the sight or ear of God, and he came down to see this city. Genesis 11:5 says, and the tower which the sons of men were attempting to build. And God said, behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language, and this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, God says, let us go down, and let us confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad, because they were attempting to be self-centered and make a name for themselves rather than worshiping God. There's no question that they knew where they had come from. There's no question that they must have known what God had done on behalf of his people. They must have known the seriousness with which God took concerning sin in the days of Noah. Do you not think that story would have been well known in Genesis chapter 11? Considering the fact that we know it so well today, even unchurched people are quite familiar, whether they even believe it to be historically accurate or not, you would be hard-pressed to find someone who isn't aware of Noah and the flood. We have to believe that they knew, and we have to believe that they weren't just skeptical about whether or not it really happened. Yet they turned away from God and attempted to serve themselves, making a name for themselves rather than making a name for him who loved them and had given himself for them. Its name was called Babel because the Lord had confused the language of the whole earth. From there, the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. And then there's a major shift in the book of Genesis. Beginning with chapter 12, one contemporary preacher calls Genesis chapter 12 the most crucial event in the Bible between the fall of Adam and the birth of Christ. Though the human race was wicked following the fall of man, and it continued in constant rebellion against God, God had promised a redeemer. From the beginning, Genesis 3:15, we read it already, and it's continuing to be exposed here. And the details come into more clarity here with Abraham when God establishes a nation through one man, Abraham, that will one day give rise to this promised Redeemer. Now the Lord said to Abraham, chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless you and make your name great, so that you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. The Redeemer that God had promised would eventually spring from a son that Sarah, Abraham's wife, would have. God says concerning Sarah, I will bless her. Indeed, I will give you, Abraham, a son by Sarah. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her. Now, you're familiar enough with the story to know that this promise appeared to be an empty one for quite some time. Several years went by and this promise was not fulfilled. But in the end, in God's keeping of this particular promise, he not only taught Abraham a wonderful lesson, but he continues to teach even us today lessons regarding his faithfulness. Every generation since Abraham looks back and remembers God's promise to Abraham. And we realize that nothing is too difficult for God. And what appears to be impossible with man is unquestionably possible for God. But even in the midst of that, this great promise that God would give a son to Abraham and Sarah, after Isaac is born, this remarkable story in chapter 22 where God has told Abraham to go and sacrifice the very one that he had promised. And though Abraham doubted on the front end of the promise coming to fruition, here there appears to be no doubt whatsoever. He packs his daily pack and heads up the mountain with his son. They come to the place which God had told him. Abraham builds the altar, arranges the wood, bounds his son Isaac and lays him on the altar on top of the wood, stretches out his hand, takes the knife to slay his son. And at that moment, Abraham, and he said, "Here I am." We pointed out last week, it's the way God's gotten a number of folks' attention over the years. Moses, here I am. Take your sandals off. Isaiah, whom will go for me? Here am I. Send me. God responds to Abraham, "Don't stretch out your hand against the lad. Do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you've not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Abraham looked up and he sees a ram in the thicket. And he names that place, "The Lord will provide," Jehovah Jireh, because that day God did provide a substitute to take the place of the sacrifice. An incredible picture of what we have for Christ, who dies a death that we deserve to die and suffers eternal punishment that is due us because of our sin. Well, the covenant that was made with Abraham, the promise to raise up a nation from him, from his line, and to do it through Sarah, is fulfilled through Isaac, who is really one of the smaller characters in the book of Genesis. But God does continue the covenant with him. "I'll be with you, Isaac, and bless you. For to you and your descendants I'll give you all these lands. I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham." The same thing God promised to Abraham, he promised to Isaac. "I'll multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all the lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." And it continued on, not only with Abraham and Isaac, but then comes Jacob, whose name was eventually changed to Israel, which is where we think more of a nation now. It's easier for us to understand the idea of one man becoming a nation. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob transitions to Israel. He became the father of the 12 sons who became heads of the 12 tribes, one of which would be designated as the line that the Messiah would come from, Judah. Amazingly, 25% of the book of Genesis, an entire quarter of the book now, is given to this other character. And it's not Judah. It's Joseph. And we see in Joseph's life this sovereign reign of God demonstrated clearly for us to see. And God lets Joseph irritate his brothers to the point that they're so determined to get rid of him that they sell him to the Egyptians, not caring if they ever see him again. They even toyed around with the idea of killing him. One of his brothers stood up and said, "We ought to just sell him and give him a chance." Then God sees that Joseph makes it into Potiphar's house. Two primary reasons he ends up in Potiphar's house. One, so that Joseph can prove that he's competent. And two, so that Potiphar's wife is given a chance to accuse Joseph, so that he ends up in prison, because the accusation does just that. And in prison, Joseph is given the ability to interpret a few dreams. He's given the opportunity, rather, to interpret a few dreams. Eventually, through God's dealings, careful dealings, the word gets to Pharaoh that this man in prison has the ability to interpret dreams. Pharaoh's having dreams that are bothering him. He sends for Joseph. Because Joseph is able to interpret Pharaoh's dreams, he's given authority that results in Egypt having food during the great famine of the land. No one else had food. God had given Joseph this ability and had given him immense wisdom. And if that's not enough, when famine hits very hard among Joseph's family, they end up coming to Egypt. They hear that there's food there. I mean, it seems so easy for us to understand. Well, of course, I mean, we know the story. We know they're going to show up and then Joseph's going to be the one that saves them. I mean, but put yourself in that position. You're going to die soon because there's no food. You're going to run out. They aren't going just so they can have a little stored up back in their homeland. They're going to Egypt because if they don't go to Egypt, they're going to die. The famine is terrible. And God has orchestrated since the time Joseph was a boy, every event in his life so that he himself will be the savior of his family. And we see God in his covenant kindness continuing to go out of his way to orchestrate details in his people's lives to guarantee that they ultimately are rescued and with him. So Joseph's brothers basically come looking to him for food. And he doesn't turn them away, but he provides for them. Even in the end, Joseph says this, "As for you," to his brothers, "you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive." Joseph had gone through quite the hardships up until this point. We like to think of him as being, you know, governor in Egypt. And sure, that was a nice spot, but he didn't know anybody. But up until that point, being in prison, being thrown in the well, being sold into slavery, serving in Potiphar's house, being wrongly accused, all of these things were a part of his life. And here Joseph says in the end to his brothers, "You meant it for evil, but not God. God is working all things for good to those who love him, who are called according to his purpose." In our backing up and looking at all of the events, I mean, the events within the book of Genesis are really remarkable. I mean, if you had 2 hours, 3 hours free this week, you ought to sit in one sitting and read the book because the stories are fascinating. How God is taking care of his people. How committed he is to rescuing a people for himself, of keeping a covenant relationship with those who are his own. But I wonder, as we see it this morning displayed, when was the last time that you stopped to consider the details that God is no doubt arranging in your life? That he's doing it for good. You aren't just living hapstancely around, wondering, happy-go-lucky, here and there. If you belong to him, he's orchestrating every event in your life for your good. In the midst of difficult times, God is at work. A few details that we didn't point out in our fast-forwarding through Genesis. What was promised to Abraham would be that he would be given a son that would then produce a lot more sons, obviously, all the way to the point of the Messiah. You know the problem with that? Sarah was barren. Yet Isaac is born. Isaac marries Rebekah. You know the problem with that? Rebekah's barren until Jacob is born. And not just Jacob, but Esau. And then Jacob marries Rachel. She's barren. These are major problems for us, but not for God. And we see him working, orchestrating all things for his own glory and for our good so that we will trust him. And you may be saying, "Yeah, but my life is really messed up. I mean, the sin is so thick. Circumstances are so difficult." Judah, Jesus came from the tribe of Judah, who slept with his daughter-in-law, chapter 38. A terrible, shady story. God redeems the outcome. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, his daughter-in-law. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram was the father of Amminadab. I'm quoting from Matthew 1 in the genealogy of Jesus. God has redeemed what seems like a hopeless situation. Your life's not hopeless. No matter the depth of sin, no matter the weight that you feel around you, no matter the difficult circumstances that you may find yourselves in, God is sitting on the throne, ruling and reigning. And meticulously ordering every detail of your life for your own good, both now and eternally. In fact, if we look back, we see a number of sinful relationships pop up in the genealogy of Jesus. And it doesn't make these kinds of actions okay, but it displays the mercy of God, remarkable mercy and amazing grace, by taking the worst situations and revealing right before our eyes that God can and does work them for our good. When we come to the end of Genesis and see that Joseph died at the age of 110 and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. And in Exodus, we pick up right there. Joseph died and all his brothers in that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty so that the land was filled with them. And a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph, which catches us right back up to where we began in our story of the Exodus. But in closing, we would all do well to consider our life, our circumstances, our sin, our past, our present. No matter where you find yourself, it does not compare one bit to the undying commitment that God has to redeeming a people for himself. Whatever your situation, he will conquer it. He's greater than every imaginable situation or circumstance. And if he is for you, and if you are his, he is for you, then nothing will prevail against you. Not even you. Nothing will separate us from the love of Christ. May God help us to live on these truths, that he is a God who sits enthroned in the heavens doing all of his good pleasure. And his desire is to redeem a people for himself and with the great beneficiaries as a result of that. Let's pray.